Welcome back to Gold Ribbon Conversations, the podcast created to support families fighting childhood cancer in Ireland. 6 children, adolescents and young adults are diagnosed with cancer every week in Ireland. And the Gold Ribbon, which illuminates precious light, love, courage and compassion, is a symbol of strength and solidarity for each and every one. My name is Sinead O'Moore, and it is my privilege to bring you this podcast on behalf of Childhood Cancer Ireland, a charity founded by and led by parents of children with cancer and survivors who know that one of the greatest sources of strength for this fight is conversation. Throughout this podcast, I talk to families impacted by childhood cancer, as well as the experts who care for our children's health, education and happiness. Yes, we talk about the fear and the pain, but we also talk about the hope and the friendship and the community that exists here, because you are not alone. Childhood Cancer Ireland values every single donation while on its mission to help more children, adolescents and young adults survive cancer and thrive as adults, and support all those dealing with the long-term effects of illness and trauma. Joining me today is Jenny Ford to share Marley's story. Marley is a bright and happy little girl doing so well after going through so much. In 2021, when Marley was 3.5, she was diagnosed with a malignant grade 4 brain tumour and endured several life-saving surgeries and treatments. Jenny takes us through her early symptoms, a mother's intuition, the impact on the wider family, and the processing of the trauma after the fight is done. This is a beautiful and compassionate episode, full of enduring gratitude and hope. Jenny, thank you so much for joining me on Gold Ribbon Conversations. I was reading your story, which is on the Childhood Cancer Ireland's website, about Marley and about everything that she has gone through. It really is such a story of resilience and thankfully a story of survival, as she is now a very happy and thriving little girl.
Yeah, she is. Thanks for having me on, Sinead. I think Marley's story it's definitely one of resilience, and I feel definitely for us the whole way through the journey, it was one of great hope. We had to hold on to the hope that everything would be okay and that she would survive from the time of diagnosis. And even now, just hoping for a really positive, happy and healthy future for Marley.
Take us back to when, I think, and I always go here because I think it's so important for parents, because we know, but the beginning when you felt something is just not right.
Yeah. For us, in July 21, so it was the time, I don't really remember the heat wave. It was like really, really bad. Marley had started summer school after finishing her first year of play school, and she just started to get like a little bit more fatigued. She wasn't eating or drinking as much, like she was declining her favorite foods and everything like that. And my gut just started to kind of, at first it was like small whispers. I was like, this isn't her, this doesn't seem right. She almost even looked a little bit different to me. She was 3.5 at the time. And then she started complaining of headaches. So she would say, I have a pain in my head. And I'd say, is it a small pain or a big pain? And she'd say, that's just a little pain. Now it's gone. So she would say that a couple of times. I was trying to encourage her to drink more. I was thinking maybe it was dehydration because of the heat wave. But then I ended up, I couldn't silence my gut that was getting louder and louder. And I brought her to the GP. It wasn't the GP that she would normally see. He hadn't met her before. She absolutely ran wild in the GP office and he could barely get her to sit still. He was like, she's wild. Checked her out, said her, she looked great. Her height and her weight was great. And asked me why I'd brought her. And I said, my stomach is just telling me, my gut is just saying something isn't right. You know, I said, she's not eating as much, not drinking as much. And she's complaining of headaches. And he said, you know, it is a heat wave. We're seeing an influx of children that, you know, can't eat or drink as much because the weather is too warm. And then they're getting headaches because they're dehydrated. So he said, are you okay with that? And I said, I'm not too sure, but I'll come back. So then a day later, she vomited for the first time. She said she didn't like the milk at breakfast. So we kind of put it off to that. But again, it was like my gut was getting louder and louder. She vomited again at dinner, and the next day I brought her to Temple Street because she was repeatedly vomiting and very lethargic. In Temple Street, they had done bloods, which obviously a lot of stuff wouldn't show up in bloods. And they said that it was a vomiting bug. And I did say, you know, but she's telling me she has headaches. And the consultant just said, you know, we're not concerned about that it would be brain cancer. So she had passed, they had done neuroobs. She had passed with flying colours. Everything looked okay. And I think that's the important thing that I felt. Like, my gut was screaming at me at this point. But Marley presents very well, and I think that's very tricky. Some children can present very well, and they look well, and they act well, and they also, which we were later told, some children overcompensate. You know, when they're actually seen by a doctor, you'll hear the phrase that people say, they made a liar out of me. You know, they're seen by a doctor or a nurse, and all of a sudden they're jumping around and everything is fine. So we were discharged from Temple Street. And we then, a day later, we're going to go back in, and we were told we should go back through DDoc. We went through DDoc. Then, like, I was napping with Marley and tried to wake her up, and she was unresponsive. So it was at that point that we called an ambulance. And, you know, I had done a first aid course and work, and I kind of knew the four steps on what to do. And by the time the ambulance arrived, she was sitting up and chatting. And even the paramedics were like, she looks great, there's not a bother on her. And I was like, oh, we're doing this again. And I said, no, there's something really wrong. She has to go to Temple Street. You know, they said, I'd say she just needs a few bags of fluids, vomit and bug. And I said, you know, we'll just bring her there anyway. So again, in the ambulance, I was holding on to her, and she lost consciousness again. And when we went into Temple Street, the paramedics brought her in, and I had her in my arms. And a nurse or a doctor had shone a torch in her eye, and her pupil had blown. And just the doctor just said, this is not a vomiting bug. And from then on, everything just went really quickly. And because it was COVID, we were still during the pandemic. Her dad, Craig, had to wait outside. So I was inside. And, you know, they were trying to do pain tests. They were checking her obs, everything like that. And she was unresponsive. And it just went very quickly. They brought her down for an emergency CT scan. And I knew, I was with her at the time. And when they came back, they just said, can we bring Dad in? And I just knew then it was something bigger than what I ever would have imagined. And then when they brought her dad in, they just said, Marley has a significant brain tumour. And the two of us just started screaming. Like, it was a pain like I've never felt. And I know a lot of I've listened to the Gold Ribbon conversations and parents talking about that pain. It's physical. I've never, like, and I've given birth, I'm like, I've never felt physical pain, like your heart's just shattering. And out of pure shock, I looked at the consultant, and sometimes I still think of it and I almost laugh. I looked at her and just said, she's only three, she can't have that, so give it to me. And, you know, she looked at me like, I thought they were going to take me out of the room. I was absolutely wild with shock. But they just kind of gathered us together very quickly. They were absolutely incredible. Got us to sign all these forms and basically said, we need to operate now or she's going to die. So we had to sign all the forms and waivers and everything we had to do. I tried to stand up, my legs went from under me. She was just lying there on the table, and we had to kiss her and say goodbye, not knowing if we were ever going to see her alive again. And we were brought into a room beside A&E, or maybe it's part of A&E, and we had to start making the calls to our family to let them know that her daughter, that we assumed just, and we're told, just had a vomiting bug, was now possibly dying. So that was probably one of the, because she had after that many dark nights throughout treatment and very difficult nights, but that was probably the worst night of my life. Just absolutely terrified if I would ever get to see her alive again. And I just kept shaking and vomiting, like the adrenaline was just coursing through us. But she went to theatre. Her absolutely incredible neurosurgeon came and saved her life, removed all of the tumour. And we were able to go in to see her then in ICU. And it was, I was so thankful. I was so incredibly thankful. It was an absolute miracle. And we were told afterwards, her consultant that had met us in A&E, that had told us it was a significant brain tumor, said to us afterwards, you know, it was touch and go during the surgery. Like, she couldn't believe when she came up to us on Gabriel's Ward in Temple Street and saw Marley, like, with the, she had the bandage on her head, she had her soother in her mouth, and she was just not a bother on her. Like, she recovered so quickly, flying around. But I mean, once she was able to walk, she was up and down the ward, playing with the kitchen, talking to other children. And we were just incredibly grateful and hung on to the hope from then on, from the very start, just that she would survive it. I think what we had felt and what we were searching for within that week from surgery to the biopsy results, we just kept thinking, it has to be benign. She's so well, she's recovered so well, it has to be benign, it has to be benign. I also feel for myself that it was a way to survive during that week that we were waiting. I didn't really venture down the avenue of it being cancer because I couldn't really, I was still in shock from what had happened, that I couldn't really venture down that avenue. What if it's cancer and what if she dies? So we spent that week just looking at her recovery, you know, looking after her. We were in Gabriel's ward, getting the best care in Temple Street. And then we were floored again when we were brought into a room and told, listen, guys, this isn't what we would have liked to have told you, but it's a grade 4 brain cancer. It's incredibly rare. There's very few cases in the world, and it's called ETMR. So it's embryonal tumor with multi-layered rosettes. And again, we just were absolutely devastated, really devastated, because she was so well. She had recovered so quickly, and we couldn't understand how her daughter, her 3-year-old, had brain cancer. It was just so incredibly heartbreaking. And going back to her and her being in that bed in Temple Street and lying beside her, so I would sleep in the bed with her every night, and the poor nurses had to do the checks around me, you know, they were so good doing the obs, and I'd be like snoring beside her. But to have to go back to her room after your child is diagnosed with a grade 4 brain cancer, and to say, you know, everything is okay, and to be happy and to play with her and do jigsaws and everything like that, for me, that was probably, it was one of the hardest things to do, was to parent while your heart is breaking, because I just didn't, you know, I just didn't want her to have to go through anything. So we met her oncologist that evening, and straight away we just felt so reassured, because my big thing was, is this terminal or has anyone survived from this? And her oncologist was able to say that, you know, she knew of children that had survived it, and she had worked with children that had survived it. And to me, that was just another miracle we were given. And it was, so let's do it. Let's get down to it. And that's the way Marley's oncologist, Dr. Curry, the way she dealt with us from the very start was like, we are going to do this. You know, she said, we're going to throw the kitchen sink at it. And we were on the same page all the time. You know, she said, it's going to be a long road. It's going to be a hard road, but we're going to do this. And like, one of your initial questions as a parent, I was like, you know, could she lose her hair? You know, that was a big thing. It's like my gorgeous little, she had like blondie brownie curls, like beautiful curly head of hair. I'm like, would she lose her hair? And she was like, there's no doubt about it, she's definitely going to lose her hair. I found that quite upsetting at first, but much later down the line I did realize, and I think a lot of parents would agree when they've been through this, the hair loss is probably one of the smallest parts of the treatment. And many of the nurses will tell you in Crumlin and in Temple Street that the hair loss often shows that the treatment is working, that it's removing everything that, you know, sometimes it's like the sicker the child, the more it means that the treatment is whacking everything out, that it's making sure the cancer goes or doesn't return. So it was almost not a good sign, but like a positive sign. And from then on, so we did a month in St. Gabriel's Ward in Temple Street. She had 5 brain surgeries and recovered from them, because she did have side effects and difficulties. with the surgeries and had to have a shunt placed, had extra fluid, had different drains and stuff like that. And then when we were discharged from Temple Street, we moved to Crumlin and started the journey with chemotherapy.
It's so much for such a tiny little body to have.
Yes.
No, I have a 3-year-old. Okay, so I'm listening to this, fully imagining this little, I know the scale of those little humans.
Yeah.
Did she ask any questions? Did she wonder, what's happening? Why am I in these new environments? Where, like, and did you have to try and find a new language to support her through her own understanding of what was happening?
Yeah, I found that really difficult throughout the treatment. She'd say, why am I here? Like, what's going on? Why am I? And we never wanted to lie to her, but we were obviously also very aware that she was three. So we tried to put it in as simple language as possible. So for a long time, like, I mean, she would have heard us talking around the doctors and nurses and other parents and everything like that. And for a long time, we would just say, do you remember you had that pain in your head? There was a problem when you're in your head, and it's gone now, and you're getting medicine to make you better. But then, like, Mary is incredibly intelligent. She's very quick. She's very sharp. She has really good hearing. So, like, you could be two different rooms away and she can still hear you. She has her little ear pointed out. But as time went on, she was like, Mama, what is a tumor? You keep talking about a tumor. So I said, a tumor is the name of what was inside your head. And I didn't go into specifics on it. So just to give a bit of, to kind of explain how big it was, like, her neurosurgeon said the tumor had grown to the size of a grapefruit. That was inside, like, my three-year-old's head. And even looking back at photos from the day before she was diagnosed, I'm like, where did that fit? How did that happen? And that's how bad the type of tumour is, that it can grow so incredibly quickly. And so quickly after it's removed, it can grow again within a number of weeks. So we were obviously, and very consciously, looking at this all the time. But Marley was asking questions. And as time went on and she was living in the hospital, basically, you know, we were there for a very long time because the chemo was so, so intense. As time went on, she just kept asking me again and again, but why am I here? You said a tumor, but why am I here? And probably about 8 months in, and we were in St. John's Ward in Crumlin, and I was in bed with her. She was like, Mama, just tell me why. And I said, you have a thing called cancer. Because I couldn't say the C word before that. I know it might be such an Irish thing, you know, people whisper it and they find it very hard to say cancer. And I was like, how do I tell my three-year-old she has cancer, you know? But I felt like she was like, almost, come on, you know, just tell me. And I said, it's called cancer and you're getting treatment for this cancer so it doesn't return. And she never asked me again. It was like, she was like, well done for saying, you know, like, and just moved on. And she just understood after that. And we've had, in her school and everything, when she went back to school, like, she missed a year of school because of treatment. When we brought her back to her school, and I mean the support from her teachers and all of her friends, because we're bringing a child in, she had a Hickman line, she had an NG tube. I'm saying to them, you know, she might pull them out of her chest and she might bleed, so you need to put pressure on it, and her tube might come out of her nut. Like, I was giving them all these directions and they took them on like it was no problem. The support was just incredible. But children did have questions, and it was important that they understood as well. So we actually had Barrettstown come in and they did a puppet show, and they used the main puppet character as Marley and took Marley's story and said, you know, I had a tumour, I got medicine, but now I have to have this tube in my nose that helps me feed because I don't really have an appetite at the moment, and I have lines in my chest, helps me get my medicine. So it educated the other children, kind of helped give Marley a bit more strength, support, you know, and confidence in what she was going through. People understood it. And for me, that was great learning as well, that it was just like the support was there, you know, and it really, it helped her, it helped educate a lot of people on it, which I thought was brilliant and really helpful.
Childhood Cancer Ireland knows that it's often only when treatment is over that parents have a chance to breathe and start to deal with what they've been through. You may leave the experience feeling stuck in high alert mode and disconnected from your old life and relationships. Our parent workshops will offer some practical strategies to help you find you again
Our day-long workshops are happening around Ireland in 2024. To find out more and to read feedback from parents who attended last year, visit childhoodcancer.ie or find the link in our show notes. To help us to continue our services, please text GOLD to 50300 and donate €4, or visit childhoodcancer.ie for more.
You said there that the plan was to throw the kitchen sink at it, having read through the story. It was.
Yeah, it was.
There were various stages of different types of treatment all along the way, which we can touch on, of course. But more importantly, I suppose, for you, where did you, or how did you keep that resilience going, that strength going, that, okay, we go again, we're going to try this, we go again, we're going to try this, we go again. Now, as a parent, I know I would have that flame inside me too. I think we all do. But no doubt burning it comes at a cost.
Yeah, I do feel so. Out of everything that Marley had to endure during her treatment, so we started with the brain surgeries and then we moved to chemotherapy. Then through her chemotherapy in February 22, her scan showed something that looked like tumour, and we had to return and do a sixth brain surgery. And even at that point, like, I know Marley's dad was looking at me, I'd say he was like, okay, she's finally lost the plot, because it looked like tumour, you know, from what, like, her neurosurgeon said, it could be scar tissue, but he'd never seen scar tissue double in size. Like, it was unheard of. We could have left it there, but if it was tumour, she was gone. So we went in, we did another surgery, but I was saying to Marley's dad, I said, my gut doesn't feel like it's tumour. I really don't think it's tumour. I just feel, and this is the thing that I would really reiterate all the time, like, a mother's instinct and a parent's gut is just so incredibly strong. And for me, I found the chemotherapy, even though the brain surgeries were incredibly difficult, and waiting 10, 12 hours, wondering if your daughter has survived it and when they're going to come back and will they have any long-term side effects or what's going to happen, that was incredibly hard. But the hardest part was the chemotherapy. Without a doubt, it was the chemotherapy, and it was the hardest time to be able to hold on to that hope. That was probably the most difficult thing, to be able to hold on to that hope, even when you were getting results with, you know, bad scans, even when your child was looking lifeless in the bed. At one point, there was a talk of possible palliative care because things had just gotten so bad and she was so, so unwell and so frail, had dropped so much weight in so little time. I felt that's when I needed it the most. And that's when I tried to kind of reframe my perspective. And I looked at it like, you know, there's many different ways you can look at something. You could say, you know, I have to do this. She had all of her friends. We had family and friends, you know, weddings, children being born, children going back to school. That hit me hard because she couldn't go back to school. But instead of being like, we have to do this, instead of Marley being in school, I looked at it like, we get to do this. She survived things that not many children with that diagnosis survived. We get to do this. So we're going to keep doing this. And even when things got really hard, it was like, she's still here. So we are incredibly lucky that she's gotten this far. And we're going to have the hope that she's going to continue to go this far. Like, she was in intensive chemotherapy and I was registering her for school. I was like, no, like, I wasn't oblivious to what could happen. I'm well aware that she could have died. You know, we had to, during her second round of chemo, like, she had five rounds of chemo, and two of them were like the stem cell transplants. So we were in the bone marrow unit for a long time. But the second round, for some reason, just hit her really, really badly. And she was very, very unwell. And we did have to have a conversation around, you know, what if she doesn't get better? And I did have to go home and have that conversation with my family. And that was horrific. And that's something that I'm well aware that many families have to do, you know, and we know children, that have passed throughout this, you know, families that we've become friends with, I think about them all the time and their resilience. But it's, you know, you can't give up hope. You really just can't give up hope, even when, you know, there's next to nothing of it left. Even that tiny little glimmer of hope, I find, is enough to get you through. When the days got so bad, when she was so critically unwell, and I just felt like, oh, I couldn't go on another minute, I would say to myself, okay, then you just need to do this minute. You just need to get through this minute, and then we'll look forward. I've just focused purely on the present. I didn't think about tomorrow, next week, next year. I just went, if I can get through today, if that was too hard, if I can get through this hour, if I can get through this 30 minutes, you know, it was just really taking each minute at a time and holding on to that hope, because it's, I don't know where I would have been without it, because with the hope, there's resilience as well. And I just really hoped for a brighter future for her and hung on to any little positive that I could, because we had gotten this far and there's cases when other children haven't.
Take me to the present now then.
And yeah.
That hope did bring good news.
Yes.
How is she now?
She is incredible. She's, you know, we had a scan there the first week of January, and we have another clear scan under our belts. So we're 2.5 years post-diagnosis now. She is like the way she always was. She's wild. She is a great mimic. She has the best sense of humor, the most beautiful smile. She's so cuddly and so thoughtful and loving. And it's just, I look at her all the time, you know, and just pinch myself. Completely, incredibly blessed with her. And I always knew I was from the time I had her. You know, she's my one and only. So it's, she's the most special little girl. But even now more so, when I look at everything that she faced and how she faced it and the courage that she had and the bravery, resilience, but also throughout her whole journey, that sense of humour that she had, that she never lost. Like, it's something in the darkest of days that we had, and she would still be cracking jokes when she could, you know, and making all the nurses and doctors laugh, and they'd come in and say, we're just in here for a social visit, you know, like she'd say, my nurse friends and my doctor friends, and, you know, and that was part of our treatment. We were in hospital for so long. We got on so well with the most incredible staff. But she's doing great. She's in junior infants now. She has lots of friends. She is learning to read and write, and she's really, really doing fantastic. And I just couldn't be more grateful for how well she is.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm really good. I always say, as long as Marley is here and healthy, everything else is icing on the cake. And I think, and I was told about this, when treatment finishes, so like we obviously did the chemotherapy, and then after that we actually went to Germany for about 6 weeks, and that was to help the Gavin Glynn Foundation. Like, John Glynn is just incredible, and Jane Glynn, the support that they gave us, and obviously the support from our family and friends, the way people rallied around us when we needed it the most and were able to help us and keeping in touch with us. And I mean, I know a lot of people would say, what do you say? You know, what do you say to someone whose child has been diagnosed with cancer? A lot of the times you don't need to say much. It's just knowing that you're there. Like, I would have a friend who just texts me. I'd be in Crumlin in the bed with Mary. She'd just say, I love you. Just text me. I'm thinking of you, you know. And that, for me, the support hasn't wavered. And I think that's what helps me. I'm well because of Marley being well. And I'm well because we have a fantastic network of support around us. I do find at times, like we did a year of maintenance therapy after Germany. And then she rang the bell last June and finished treatment. And that was absolutely incredible. But I think it's after that stops, after treatment is done. When you're finished, you know, when you're finished fight or flight mode, and you have to kind of leave that now and actually face everything, you know, it was for me kind of learning what to do to adapt to another, you know, another new world. And how am I going to cope and continue to parent the best that I can and deal with all the trauma. So for me, it was like joining a gym. I'm in a great women's gym, spending time with friends and family, going to therapy, and just really trying to process everything and navigate how we move forward, and also keeping a very close eye on Marley, because I always do, and just making sure everything is okay. And I don't think that's something that will ever leave me. I'll always be watching her like a hawk, but you know, it's all normal, I suppose.
Is it strange to accept that she's well? Like when you are locked in such a mind state of she has cancer and she had a brain tumor and the operations, to then move into that state of, no, we're good again. And to actually have your body at a cellular level believe it.
It is definitely strange. I feel like it was a long time coming, because she was very well when we were in Germany. So really the brain surgeries and the chemotherapy were really, really incredibly difficult. By the time we went to Germany for the proton therapy, Marley was so well. She had an absolute ball in Germany. And she still says, like, I want to go back to Germany on holidays. And I'm like, I have trauma. I don't want to go back there too soon. And she's like, I really want to go back to Essen. When can we go back and see my friends there? And, you know, so she had a great time in Germany and she was very well. So I feel like from the time of proton onwards, we started to get a glimpse of her being healthy again. So it was kind of a slow and steady course, getting used to her being well again. And it didn't kind of hit us like a bang. It was very slow and steady. So you could really get used to it and get to grips with it and take your time with it. I do find like sometimes it is surreal, you know, that she's here and she's so well. But sometimes I still find that it's surreal that she was actually sick in the first place. You know,
did that happen?
Exactly. And sometimes I think that it's, you know, the whole thing is surreal. You almost have like PTSD afterwards. You know, you're like, did that actually happen? And sometimes I'll hear sounds that will trigger something. You know, I'll hear a blood pressure monitor, like my nana was in the hospital. She had passed last year, but I heard a blood pressure monitor and I immediately jumped up because it sounded like the one in Crumlin. And my mom looked at me and I was just like, oh, it just reminded me of Crumlin, you know. And I've no problem with that when I'm in Crumlin with Marley and she's getting checkups. But it sometimes your nerves, just everything just stands up to attention and you're, you know, you're right back where you were when that happened.
It can also very naturally have such an impact on your wider family network, because so many people love your little girl.
For me anyway, and I know for Marley's dad, for Craig and his family, like we have incredible families and we're very close anyway, so we're very lucky in that regard. I, for a long time, because we were just so focused on Marley, we didn't really know what truly happened the day we had to make those phone calls to tell them, you know, that Marley had a tumor. But it was kind of later down the line, you know, my family had told me what had happened, and you know, when I called and people fell to pieces, people fell to their knees. And it's something that, you know, we wouldn't even think about, oh God, how did they react when we told them? Because you're so set on this path of that fight or flight mode and just fighting, 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 that you almost don't think about how powerfully it impacts the rest of the family and how powerless they feel, how helpless they feel in the wake of this, because really there's not much that anybody can do apart from be there. You know, and I know that sounds, you're like, how can I be there? Just to hug, just to support, just to send that message, if it's once a week or once a month, you know, just to be there. Like we were there too. My friends got it together and like had bags of like pajamas, socks, pants, you know, stuff we wouldn't even think of. You know, it was like a diary, a journal to any family going through it. I would say just keep a journal, and I would write words in it. I'd write sentences, paragraphs. I haven't looked at it since. I don't know if I'll ever be able to. But that support, they did things we didn't even think of. Like I couldn't even drive at the time because I couldn't think straight, so I couldn't drive properly. My brother would pick me up from Crumlin when myself and Craig were swapping over and doing overnights with Marley. And he would just listen to me. Like, I'd, you know, when her hair started falling out and I had her hair in my hand and I came out of his car and just sat in the car and just burst into tears. And he just listened to me the whole way home. And that was it. You know, that was more than enough for me. And I'm always grateful for all of the support that we had from all of our family and our friends and our colleagues and work and everything like that, just to be able to be there, even without being there physically, because we were living in the hospitals and because it was COVID and we had to be super careful. The support meant the world to us. Like, we were told she was prayed for all around the world. People were praying everywhere, you know, and it was, that was, we're very, very grateful for that. And it's something that I'll never forget, but I can't even imagine, I can't even begin to imagine the impact that I had on those who loved us, and more importantly, those who love Marilee, because it's, you know, a cancer diagnosis for a child, a three-year-old child. It was just devastating, beyond devastating.
So glad that you listened to your intuition. I'm so glad that we have it as mothers. But sometimes we can forget to listen to it, or we can be told other things that feel like we want to believe them. But the intuition is always there. And it is so powerful, and it is very guiding. And it is something that repeatedly comes up in these conversations, that I am now left in no doubt that it is something there to keep us all safe and connected. Connected to our children, even when they are outside of our bodies. Does it stay with you now that she is well? And I know you said you watch her like a hawk. Can it be difficult to manage that intuition when also there can be so much anxiety attached to it?
Yeah, that would be a big thing for me now. I mean, throughout treatment, I had a lot of anxiety. I'm dealing with it appropriately and kind of looking after myself very well. But during treatment, I had to learn, I had to hone in on, is this anxiety? Is this my intuition, or is this anxiety? Because sometimes they feel the same, but actually deep down, they're very, very different. And it's hard to kind of put it into words. But for me, my anxiety leaves me feeling very nervous and very, you know, questioning, overthinking, getting really panicky. My intuition is something that's very guttural and very deep and doesn't leave me and is unwavering. And it's something that I continually ask myself, even when Marilee's had her scan or if she vomits, you know, anything like that, which is normal childhood illnesses, I will go, is this my intuition or is this anxiety? A lot of the time it's anxiety, and I learn how to cope and adapt and look after it. But my gut is something that is unwavering. And I feel throughout her treatment, it just got stronger and stronger, because after she was diagnosed, like, if we hadn't have brought her by ambulance that day, she would have died. And we know that now. And I'm so, so incredibly glad that we did, and that it happened, and that she got the help that she needed, and that her life was saved. But it made me realise just how strong my gut is, and that I can't ignore it, I can't deny it. And you just need to do whatever you can do. You are your child's advocate, and nothing else matters. And you just push and push and push until you get there. And at the end of the day, if people are wondering, as I often wondered, but what if I'm wrong? Well, if you're wrong, then you just get to go home with a healthy child. You know, if you're wrong and they do a CT scan and it's clear, isn't that great news? Like, that's what I think now. It's like, I have, through her treatment, during maintenance therapy, I have brought her into Crumlin, and they would do the checks. I'd say, I just don't feel she's right. And she had this, I had to give this chemotherapy. We were doing oral chemotherapy at home. There were one or two times where everything was fine and I got to bring her home, and I thought, yeah, that was probably more anxiety. You know, that's fine. It's, if you're wrong, you're wrong, and you get to bring your child home. But if you don't follow your gut, you know, things can change in an instant, and it can be absolutely devastating. So for me, it's really just been practicing to hone in on that gut feeling and listen to it really well.
It's an incredible story. It's all of these stories stay with me. They always teach me something. something. They always change something about my perspective, about my motherhood, about life, about my awe for the human ability to get through the greatest challenges that can be faced, but also how hope can win. And Marley being here and well and in school and a life ahead of her is proof that good news can come from the worst. And if we can take anything from an experience that no child should happen, it's to hold on to that, to hold on to seeing that little girl is now well, and that can happen for other people with the right teams and the right treatment and the right intuition and the right advocacy. I'm so, so glad that we can share what is a horrible story with a happy ending on this podcast and give people that hope. I can't begin to understand what you've lived, but I can see from how you speak that there's a new strength. You've taken these lessons. You've told me them in the last hour. You're an incredible mother, an incredible human to have gotten through this. It's so clear that it's going to set you up for the decades ahead, where you're going to watch your daughter like a hawk and keep. Well done. Well done for getting through it, for finding that strength. Well done for following your intuition. And thank you so much for sharing it with us all so that we can take some strength from it.
Thank you so much, Sinead. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this Gold Ribbon Conversation. There are more Gold Ribbon stories written by those fighting childhood cancer on our website, childhoodcancer.ie, and you'll find a link in our show notes. If you can, we would love you to share this podcast across social media using hashtag Gold Ribbon Conversations, as it can help more families to discover this show. This podcast was produced by The Brand Story for Childhood Cancer Ireland, hosted by Sinead O'Moore, and sound production by Alan Breslin.